Hello and welcome to Lush Tums, the podcast, supporting you on your mothering journey during pregnancy, birth and beyond. Through yoga, education and community, we enable every woman we work with to connect more deeply to herself and her own innate wisdom. Find your tribe as you become a parent, making positive, informed choices that are right for you, because Lush Tums believes everything has a place. Join the two Claires as we connect, laugh and learn. In this space, everything is welcome. Hello and welcome to Lush Tums, the podcast. I'm Claire McGill. Today we're joined by Kemi Johnson. Kemi is an experienced birth worker, former NHS and independent midwife in the UK, dedicated to making birth better for everyone. We have been following Kemi's brilliant social media for a long time, loving how she uses her knowledge and passion to educate and question commonplace practices within midwifery and obstetrics. Kemi empowers people to expect more from their care, to ask questions, and to say no. Welcome, Kemi. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I love talking about childbirth. It's one of my favouritest things.
You're in good company then, because that's definitely our favouritest thing to talk about as well. I've been following you on Instagram for a long time, as has Claire, and we love all your posts and particularly the passion behind the information that you give. Makes it really compelling reading, and so I'm very often sharing the things that you write. But I would love to know some more about your journey and how it all started. So you were originally a midwife. What led you to become a midwife?
It was a calling. It sounds so pompous, but it was at the age of 15. I mean, okay, I'll take it back further. Between the age of 4 and 9, sorry, it's a dark start, but between the age of 4 and 9, I never really slept. I was that child with the dark rings under their eyes because I had a nightmare every night that I was being burnt. It's horrible, right? Came out of the blue at age 4. My mum took me places to try and make it stop, but it didn't stop until I kind of shouted at it, please stop. And then it stopped at the age of 9. Then at the age of 15, I heard about what a midwife was. And I was already on the path to being a doctor. I got a scholarship for private school and was trying to get all these amazing grades. And then heard at the age of 15 that actually I'm supposed to be a midwife. And yeah, it's just literally I woke up from a dream again, really spooky sounding stuff. Woke up from a dream, it was meant to be a midwife. I spoke to my dad about it to try and see how compatible it was with all the dreams they'd worked so hard for. And it wasn't. So we had an argument about it and I went and became an accountant instead. So, yeah. So, because I honestly didn't think I was responsible enough to have a mother and her baby in my hands at the time, just hadn't had enough life experience. And so I was an accountant until my mid-30s, and then I'd acted up for my finance manager, and she'd gone away for about 6 weeks or so, and I'd acted up for her. And then when she was at the airport, she said, it was on a Thursday, I remember so specifically, she said, if you let me come to the office now, if you wait, you can do handover and then have a long weekend and not come back till Monday. And I thought, yeah, fine, and started to just tidy up my desk, etc. And then she walked in and found me just hosing tears. It sounds so dramatic, but I was inconsolable, projectile crying. And I didn't know why. And then she looked at me and said, what's wrong? And then I looked straight back at her and the words came to her, I need to be a midwife now. So it was so weird. It's so weird. And I didn't know it was coming. And it just kind of fell on me. And, you know, when I was reflecting on it, I thought maybe because I'd acted up and it wasn't all that, you know, I'd been offered to go and work for Coopers and Lybrand as an auditor. Didn't fancy that. the only thing I really wanted to do was be a midwife. So that's when I started my training.
So with those early dreams, are you feeling like past life experience, you were a midwife that got burnt for your beliefs and your work? Yeah. Kemi's nodding furiously at us down the camera. Wow.
It's you made me so go all goosebumpy, Kemi. Beyond my control. So I can't pretend that it was, you know, there was anything truly virtuous about it. I wasn't called or drawn to save the babies or anything. It was just laid on me. I must admit, though, that my own birth experience then dovetailed with my calling. And my own birth experience was so horrendous at the age of 24. And I'd been a healthy woman who'd never had an operation and then suddenly had a failed unnecessary induction that cascaded to a cesarean that had kind of become necessary. My son did not enjoy being pounded through my bones. He didn't enjoy it at all. And so it was a cesarean, but because of an unnecessary induction. And then that helped bring a bit more clarity to my feeling.
So had you begun your training when you became pregnant?
No, I started my training in my 30s. It's my second career childbirth. I gave birth at 24 and 26.
And the birthing experiences, it wasn't those moments that made you feel that you needed to have that calling, or did it reaffirm that actually this was somewhere you should be?
So good you asked that, because it's quite nuanced. Yes, I knew at the age of 15 that I wanted to be a midwife. My dad was my first love, and his disapproval laid heavy on me. So even though I'd had really rubbish births, I still wasn't compelled to become a worker in the birth space until I was dragged by that projectile crying. That's when I was dragged. I literally had no choice. So it's almost like I ran another 10 years and then just ground to a halt and said, no, I have to be a midwife. Oh shit. I was frightened, and it's a big responsibility. I took it really seriously. And then obviously, you know, what I was fearful of, which is childbirth, you know, that's silly. That was my grooming. What I needed to be fearful of was the institution, the NHS, and their groomlings. That's what I really need to be afraid of. That's what nearly pushed me over the edge, the training and the abuse from other midwives. You know, from registered midwives.
What did you see then? How was your experience as a midwife for that period of time for you? What did you see, you know, in the birth space for women as well?
That's really strange, because I literally just welled up with tears when you asked me that. And this is 20 years later. So, almost 20 years. I'm 57 now. So, yeah, it's just misogyny. I once saw a midwife hold a woman's sanitary pad with gloves like it was nuclear waste. And she just had it on her table. So alarming. I'm so upset. She had it on her little table, so she's trying to... It's her first baby. She's trying to manage Lokia, breastfeeding. I don't know if she'd had a cesarean or not. A lot more first-time mothers. The majority of first-time mothers now have a cesarean. But at the time, that was back, you know, almost 20 years ago. And I saw a midwife. We're supposed to love women. We get vomited on. We get amniotic fluid on us. And yet she was handling it like it was nuclear waste, and her face was all screwed up. And she was talking to another midwife, said, how could she leave it on her table where she eats? That's what she said. But it's our blood. Yeah. Is it that distasteful? You know, I mean, that's just a slightly nuanced one from somebody who's a lover of people. So I can't stand people being demeaned in that way. But the worst things were the screams of women on labour ward. That was by far, I had no idea that I literally needed to run out of that situation. So I would dread being on the labour ward, and then I'd hear screams like a woman's being cut or set alight in a room, because not, and it's not the same guttural from the power of birth. It's like someone climbing up a bed to get away from torment screams happening on a labour ward. And then I realised I just couldn't be there. So then I asked to be part of the home birth team. And they said, no, you're a newly qualified midwife. You have to be a preceptor. Said, so what's this preceptorship? Oh, it involves being on the labour wards. So they're like, but I can't be on the labour wards. So then I managed to squirrel some shifts on the birth centre, which was an exhale. But I already had the seed planted by independent midwives in my second year of training that really I need to become an independent midwife. So,
The idea of going into a place where you're wanting to care and look after people and to hear them screaming like that, I can't imagine how hard that must have been. And
sorry, it was intolerable. It was intolerable.
Do you think that's why there's other midwives might actually have PTSD from experiencing that kind of sound and visual day in, day out?
Yes. Yeah. And compassion fatigue. I think it's the big one for why they just don't care. So I know it's difficult for people every time I'm confronting them with the realities, but I'm actually, apart from being driven to, it's my calling to speak the truth and to whistleblow. It's also, I'm hoping that midwives are getting woken up. I hope that it's a short, sharp shock. I hope when they see that they're actually committing abuse, I hope that they see that they're committing violent acts, that they're committing violent criminal acts. I'm hoping every time I say that, just another midwife will go, oh God, I am. The majority won't, because they're groomed and they're cooked. But I think there's a large minority that could wake up and leave the services. They're not going to be able to change it, because the majority of them are PTSD, compassion fatigued. And some people are attracted to the system because they can be cruel to women.
Wow, that's a real dark underbelly that, you're really shining a light on that. So do you think that is the most critical thing that's happening in the birth space at the moment? Or are there other things that are important to your heart that you want to speak about?
I do not want to be a downer on your podcast. I could fill the whole space with the stories I hear. But actually, I've also expressed that I want to be part of the solution, that I want to be talking up the what could be available. Some people say, okay, so why don't you spend a lot of time talking about how to change the NHS? I don't think it can change. I think it was developed this way, and it's doing what it was set up to do. Honestly, women who work for the women, the vast majority of people giving birth are women, some are not. So that's why I use the term women, but I will also say birthing people, I'm inclusive, right? That those that serve us are mostly women. And so I think it fits the purpose that we're all being downtrodden and abused. We're all being bullied on both sides, receiving the care and giving the care, right? So I don't think the NHS, I don't think NHS maternity services can be fixed. Much as I'm grateful for being able to access care at the point of need, the abuse that goes with it has far outweighed the benefit. So I'm done with the NHS, right? Yes, of course, their surgery, provided it's performed properly, and now they're performing so many surgeries, they're being quite slapdash, and so the quality of surgery is going down. But one of the good things is that there are a lot more women, birthing people and their partners, prepared to explore the possibility of autonomous birth, of accepting full responsibility for their own health and that of their children. The backdrop being the last 3 years, which is for another podcast maybe, where people were asked to disengage their brains and just do as they're told. And now, sadly, many, many people are suffering the health consequences of that. But again, even though that is awful, the silver lining is that it's woken so many more people up to the idea that a registrant can lie to you and not have the evidence and not have the safety data and still recommend something. Mm. And as horrible as that is, it's the silver lining is that more people are going, wait, what? And asking more questions and making choices outside of the established maternity service.
So are you seeing that more and more now as a trend in birthing choices that, it, you know, from what me and Claire have been doing for years, it's all been about education and empowerment and getting people to think positively about their experiences and trying to make informed decisions. But what's the sort of big trends that you're seeing across birth choices that people are making these days?
I love that. I love that that has been your focus. And this is what was needed. I think many of us started to say, OK, we need to be sharing the truth about pregnancy, childbirth and infant nurture. And then it's kind of snowballed. Then we brought hypnobirthing into it. And that was great because it was giving people a little hack for their mindset. Because, you know, when I used to teach it regularly, I would regularly say, we are brainwashing you, but it's kind of, it's a reset, it's a default, yeah? But now it's gone even further than that, and people are looking at their life experiences, what they learnt from it, what they can bring into maternity or their childbirth experience. So they're taking it much wider. Even there's something called matrix re-imprinting, which is kind of an offshoot of tapping, EFT, which is done by Carmen Rocha, who's one of my very close colleagues that I'm now collaborating with, which is literally like pressing a reset button. So some people that might want to spend years in therapy trying to get over their fears of childbirth, you could have one or two sessions of matrix imprinting and do that. Yeah. So I'm pleased to see all, you know, people using Reiki, people are using fascia release, you know, myofascial release, yeah. Or acupuncture, etc., to optimize their physiology for childbirth. And then there's us serving them who, like me, I was on the register as a nursing midwifery council registrant, but then I released myself from that almost 3 years ago and now working as a birth keeper, which means I can recommend herbs, I can carry herbs, I can use homeopathy. You know, I'm free mm-hmm. to, you know, make the recommendations that I make without somebody coming and trying to medicalize me. The mm-hmm. care I give is holistic. Yes, it includes some medical parts. There's some people that I say, boy, you're ill. I think you need to go to the hospital. Why? Because they deal with pathology. And they're a quick fix for pathology. Actually, in the long term, you probably find that herbal remedies are better, hypnosis is better, but that takes longer in most cases, except for some herbs work quicker than allopathic medicine, which, you know, there's something else I'm learning about. I'll be becoming a naturopath soon. I'm going to be doing a postgrad in naturopathy. So there's lots of positive, wonderful opportunities now, but to take each one, it's going to take courage. Mm. It's going to take courage, each one. Even me deregistering took enormous courage to do that. Women choosing people outside of the system with no insurance, mm-hmm. they are taking enormous amounts of courage to do that. Courage to speak to their lovers, their partners, their mothers. It's just taking a whole lot of courage. You guys doing this podcast takes courage. It I feel like just putting a little meme up with that word, because I think that's what it's taking right now. Midwives that have been grooved but have woken up in the system. Mm-hmm. It's taking courage for them to leave it. It's taking courage for them to be IMs. Some of them are deregistering and becoming doulas. It takes courage to do that. But I'm excited.
Yeah, it's been a big sort of trend, I think, over the last couple of decades of empowering people with their birth choices. But like, kind of swinging back to the midwifery part, when I've worked like midwifery study days with all the trainee midwives coming in, and I can really see that, you know, they all come in with the intention to help. They want to make birth better. They're passionate about birth. Maybe
they don't all, Claire.
But on the whole, you get the vibe that, you know, they're drawn to this as, you know, a calling as well to help in that birth space and do something good. So it's like, what is it that happens along the way that creates, you know, what's so broken about the system that means they can't do the bit that they got drawn to do with the midwifery in the first place?
I spoke to a doula once who recounted a story where the midwife was, I mean, really actively doing harm in the end towards the woman that she was supporting. And as she was telling me this story, I could feel this rage kind of, you know, how dare she? How can she do that? This vulnerable person, why would she do these things? Why would she take these actions? And then the doula said to me, because she's unsupported. And she said she went to that midwife afterwards, and the midwife was in bits, because although she had been the instigator of whatever, obviously that she was torn within herself that that's not what she wanted to do. That's not who she set out to be. She could see what she was doing. She didn't want to be doing it. And so when the doula had a private, you know, conversation with her, she said, I know why you've done what you've done. It's because you're unsupported. And I kind of feel like that is the case across the board, that midwives, whereas they used to be, they're trusted to listen to their judgment, to use their skills, to tune into the woman in front of them. They're now not supported to do that and to offer that kind of care.
And that's an aspect of it too. Mm. And I think it's really valuable that you shared that, because for some midwives, that is the issue. For other midwives, it's their first grasp of power with people that are exceptionally vulnerable. And it turns them on. That's what they really want for that day. You know, like when people get on, it depends sort of kind, there's different types of people. Some people say, well, of course, you know, Thorpe Park is a draw for, you know, thousands of people a year. You know, why wouldn't you want to go on, you know, the big roller coasters, and, you know, why wouldn't you want to do that? Because some people are addicted to the adrenaline rush of doing that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's an adrenaline rush to saving the day in midwifery when you've got somebody who can't see their feet, who's frightened because their amygdala is extra sensitive during their pregnancy, so they're easily scared and they easily comply. Some people have never had that power, and so they get it in maternity services and they get drunk on it. There's loads of reasons why the majority of midwives, let's stick to midwives, obstetricians, as you know, in this too, there's loads of reasons why they are committing the crimes. But, you know, the response that midwife that you mentioned, Claire, gave was a contrite one. It sounds mm-hmm. like contrition, like, oh, I'm sorry. Many more would have responded defensively. Like what's happened to me, you know, I was an independent midwife supporting my client. She'd put very clearly on the birth plan, you know, unless my baby's dying, you keep that umbilical cord intact. Obviously now the evidence shows that if your baby's dying, even more reason to keep it intact, right? But so that's what she put in her birth plan, and they were desperate to do what they usually do, which is cut and clamp straight away and whisk the baby over to the resuscitator to be wrapped up like a burrito and all the rest of it. So they had their ritual versus what the woman actually wanted. On our Nursing and Midwifery Council, it was rules and standards at the time. Now they call it the code, right? The rules and standards completely said, keep the woman in the centre of the care, whatever she wants, she gets, even if you don't agree with it. It says that in the code. And yet, you know, God, was it 13 years ago, I was in a situation where I had to throw my body over the umbilical cord to prevent them from cutting it, because it's like hell bent, scissors poised, I must cut the cord, right? Rituals. So we've got our really deep reasons for why they are committing these crimes, and then we've got really shallow, I am a robot reasons why they do it. Oh, or some of them are just plain stupid. So, you know, they call it cord blood as if it's not the blood of the baby. It's not cord blood, it's baby blood. Yeah, so whatever you do with it, you are robbing the baby. If you do anything other than leave the cord intact, you're robbing the baby. So you have to be quite silly to be working day in, day out in that environment and realize that you're not, and not realize that you're doing that. So I've got a multitude of reasons why.
Yeah. So if we were to speak to, which we are, you know, we've got a lot of pregnant people listening to our podcast, coming to our Lush Times classes all over the place. You work with a lot of pregnant people. Sometimes I find when I'm teaching antenatal ed or pregnancy yoga, and we have little conversations about just some of the things that might happen in labour, in birth, it's genuinely the first time people have thought about their bodies in this way, body parts, what happens physiologically, since they did maybe GCSE biology about 20 years before.
Yeah.
And even then it was rubbish diagrams.
It was so bad.
And nothing about emotions or coping or mindset. It's just like, here's a diagram of your uterus. Yeah. This is how you get the baby in. This is how you get the baby out. Standard, boring, really rubbish. So it's like, you know, they're really wet behind the ears in a really naive and innocent way. It's like, you know, that's the majority of the client base, really. They haven't looked at this at all for 20 years. Yes. And this is a brand new subject, and they're already 6 months pregnant and shitting themselves and birth around the corner.
Yes.
So, you know, Claire and I have been saying for years, we need armies of us, Kemi, like out there.
Yes.
Providing information and educating and giving them tools in the box. To help them make their own informed and empowered choices and understand what some of these things that might arise, you know, to give them a bit more capacity and agency. So if we were to like bottle it down, you know, what would you say could be like the top three or top five things we want to tell and share to new pregnant people to help them have, you know, the best possible birth outcome that they can?
Oh, dear. Oh, that's put me on the spot because there's so many. I'm trying to think of my top five. Okay. The first one that forms in my brain is that childbirth isn't a medical event. Okay. So please stop taking yourself into hospital for childbirth. Of course, take yourself into hospital if you become ill during childbirth. Yeah. So like now, for instance, we've got people being diagnosed with gestational diabetes. So they're getting that diagnosis. They're offered the opportunity to kind of optimize their glucose levels with diet or using one of the numerous drugs, right? The two top ones would be metformin and, you know, insulin sometimes as well. So they're offered that for the gestational diabetes. But then what happens is the holistic physiological birth is taken off the table for no reason. Yeah, if you've optimized your glucose levels, the holistic physiological birth needs to remain on the table. But maternity services takes that off the table. So it's for these amazing women populating our planet to know that just because you may have a condition doesn't mean you can't have a holistic physiological birth. The two are different choices. Right? How do I treat my illness is different from how do I give birth to my baby. How you give birth to your baby, there's a hole at the bottom of your torso that babies fall out of. That's what you need to aim for, okay? That's what you need to optimize. The vast majority of people do not have gestational diabetes. They do not have essential hypertension. What they might have, though, are conditions associated with not quite managing your minerals, vitamins, supplementation, nutrition well enough to carry a baby without causing things like preeclampsia or intrahepatic cholestasis of pregnancy, obstetric cholestasis, also known as, right? So I've already covered three things, right? So the first thing is please let your default be giving birth at home. Childbirth has happened for hundreds of thousands of years out of the medical setting. We've proven it over and over again. Even The Lancet proved it with two big studies in 2019 and 2020, early 2020, that giving birth on the labour ward causes more iatrogenic harm than if you were to give birth at home. It's a better option even for people with a high risk labour. So, you know, even people with raised BMI, you know, all the lists that you can think of. So the first thing is please let your default be a home birth and only go in to the hospital if you need medical assistance whilst giving birth. The other thing I mentioned was how are our bodies prepared to carry a whole human? That preparation, optimizing that, you know, the book Real Food for Pregnancy by Lily Nichols, etc. Let's just talk about what we're putting in our bodies. That is just essential for everyone, especially, and you're going to find this quite challenging to hear, especially those in the Western world. So I'm here in Africa at the moment, and women are naturally well nourished because they eat from the land. Yeah, they grow all their own food and it's fresh and the land is fertile. And they don't overwash things. Like, you know, we are connected with the soil. We feel the soil under our feet, etc. That's not the same in the UK, for instance, which is where I was born and bred. So it's even more important for people in the UK or in the US who are pregnant to really find out what the building blocks are of a healthy body, a body healthy enough to carry a healthy baby. So the other thing that I would mention as well is how we move our bodies. Again, it will challenge people to know that here in Africa, we don't sit down very often. We're very agile. And I say we because I've now had to, thank God, optimize my lifestyle to the way people are. So we're constantly jumping in and out of transport, picking up children, you know, running into the sea, dancing. You know, we're constantly moving our bodies, which is really good because, you know, we don't get bored, we don't get rained indoors. You know, I don't have a TV. So, you know, there's lots to help us move, lots. And I think sometimes in the UK, I can speak of because that's where I was born and bred, we don't move as much as we ought to. I then think about when you're not in an environment where they're freely offering heroin in the form of fentanyl or ephedrine or whatever. When you're not in that environment, you're more likely to use your own internal resources. Sadly, in the UK, things get offered too readily. So a woman may say, oh, you know, they may suspect this low pape fiasco, which is another conversation, and be told, oh, it can cause, I'll tell you what it says. They said, oh, it could be stillbirth, premature birth, growth restriction or preeclampsia are the warnings for low pape. So then they lean forward and they say, so I'm going to give you aspirin. But we've already discovered from Dr. Brewer and his cohort of 25,000 women that actually what you put in your mouth is more likely to have a positive impact on, you know, on reduction of preeclampsia, stillbirth, premature birth, and growth restriction. So he's already fixed it. But they'll just come and offer aspirin and then tell you, oh, you need to be induced at 39, 40 weeks because you're on aspirin and you've got low papain. So it doesn't make sense, rather than giving women the solutions. Because like you have been doing, you two have been doing, you've been working to enable the women to take back their power. Mm-hmm. But when you just offer a pill, that's doing the opposite. That's making her dependent on a pharmaceutical, rather than saying, actually, if you watched what you ate and moved a bit more, you'd be all right.
Mm. It's sort of shifting the responsibility from the woman herself to be able to take control of her own body to saying, don't worry, we've got this, take this, and then we can, this is the action we are going to be taking to make now happen.
That's right. And that leads me on to the fifth thing, the antenatal grooming. It's not antenatal care, it's antenatal grooming. So it just links to what you just said, Claire. Right from before we were even pregnant, we're taught to just take ourselves along, pop ourselves along to the GP, and then they slot you into a medicalized care system, which is pathologizing everything about you. You're too skinny, you're too fat, you're too old. Yeah. And then you become very dependent and like, okay, save me, doctor. And they'll say, yeah, we'll save you. You'll end your pregnancy at 38 weeks. And then when the wheels come off of your labor, we'll get you into theater for major abdominal surgery. That's their solution. Is no part of that is empowering. And people need to remember that when you've had a cesarean, subsequent children are at a higher risk of stillbirth. It is not an easy choice. Okay. Mm. So, you know, just what you said, the power needs to remain with the woman, and nourishing that needs to be her lover, her partner, her husband, her mother, because us mums are brutal when it comes to disempowering our daughters. Sorry, gotta be said. Got a big responsibility. I've got a 32-year-old and a 30-year-old son, okay? I could have crushed them equally, and I mustn't, but we crush our daughters and then hand them over to medicalised maternity care. We've got to stop doing it.
Is that in the name of what, you know, it's out of what we feel is love, but really it's fear and protection.
That's right.
Kind of trying to prevent what happened to us from happening to them by kind of doing the same thing in a very backwards way.
That's right. And you've got some mums that are jealous of their daughters as well. Sorry, I always have to bring the dark side because it's there. It's there. But it is, you know, the major part of it, absolutely, you're both right. It's about us thinking, well, we kept safe because we were compliant and good girls. So we'll crush our daughters to make them good girls and compliant. But the reality is that this has not worked out well for us at all.
No. And that good girl theme runs across all of patriarchy, whereas actually we need mouthy girls that can say what they want to say and do what they want to do.
That's the one. But we beat that out of them. We beat that out of them when they're little.
And let's be there. What did my mum used to say to me? She used to say something like, you know, you've got to stick up for your kid and let them be exactly who they need to be, because the rest of the world is going to be tearing them down. So you do your best to stick up for them.
Love your mum.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. And it's harder. It's a harder job when you've got someone up in your face, you know, like, you know, my children, because I didn't just raise my own two. Yeah, they all would answer back, challenge me, why, you know, when they're in their teens, they were brutal. They would say, well, we're certainly not going to do what you did. It didn't work out for you. So we're not, what my eldest son said, Mum, anything you've got to offer in the form of advice is obsolete now. what he said. Ooh. Obviously, until he became a parent.
So, Kemi, you did mention before about this word about ritualization in medical practice, and that really struck a chord for me. But now I also then heard you're in Africa and women are connected to the land. And I've got a curious question of, like, what are the rituals that happen to support and nourish and love the pregnant women in your in your homelands throughout pregnancy and
Very
birth?
Good.
What are those beautiful rituals
Very
that we can maybe
good.
Learn from?
Well, what I'll tell you is, in the cities where I am, women are fucked because they're all trying to do it the British way.
Oh.
It's terrible. I saw that huge eye roll, Claire. It's like thinking, oh, well, if we're more anglicised in the way we do maternity care, it's better. Like, no. So, you know, the women who by far benefit from all what I just told you are not living in the city. The city women, sadly, we're all going to restaurants and eating the wrong food and offering ourselves up to medicalised maternity care. But thankfully, the majority of people do not live in the city. So they're having amazing lives, you know, physiological births, excellent, you know, really low mortality rates, really low morbidity rates. Yeah, they're doing really well. They're doing fine.
Great.
So what can we learn from it? You've got to stop letting the government run your countries. And say yours. It's like mine too. I was born and bred there. But you've got to stop letting the government run it. Like here in this country, you know, and another country I'm fond of, which is Mexico as well, you know, the government try and roll out an edict. And like the infrastructure just doesn't support enforcing it. So just like, yeah, right, just do our own thing. and that's the way we protect ourselves, by, you know, just saying, you know, feign compliance and absolutely do the opposite of what's been recommended.
So if you were to be in a birthing space in Africa, as opposed to, say, the birthing space that we more commonly see over here, what would look different? If you were walking into that room, how would you know what's there that supports those births?
Well, very interesting, because like the Africa is a continent. I've got to say, I'm in the country of Tanzania, right? Mm-hmm. So what you see in a community birth, home birth in Tanzania, is exactly what you'd see in a home birth in the UK. Yeah? So it's exactly the same. You'll see, it might be a family birth. You'll see family around, you know, there'll be trips to the bathroom, trips back to the room where the pool's set up. You know, a few people are having pool births here now, but they use a paddling pool. So, you know, so yeah, I'm supposed to be getting some birth pools over because they're deeper, so they're more likely to cover the bump. But they've got nice deep paddling pools that get used here. Most people won't use a pool, they'll use land. But they've got people massaging them, nourishing them, holding them whilst they cry. It's virtually identical. When you go into a maternity or a labour ward birth in the UK, it looks the same as a maternity ward here. If you're in a well-resourced hospital, looks virtually the same. If you're in a poorly resourced hospital, then obviously it's full of broken equipment, etc. But they'll still force women onto their backs with their legs in the air. So, yeah.
I love that actually you can be anywhere in the world, and even if your perhaps birth imprint was a bit different growing up, you could still benefit from someone else's birth imprint and the ideas and the techniques that have supported them. Love the idea of touch and massage. I mean, that seems like something you don't see a regular image of on television. You know, I think when we think about people that are coming up to giving birth the first time, and as Claire sort of said, hadn't really thought much about our own biology since GCSE, it's not like it's been blank all that time. There's been heaps of things going on that have led them to think that they know and understand what's supposed to happen. And actually a lot of that information is not based on from any reliable source. It's TV shows and, films and you know, stories that have been chopped and changed along the way, usually the bad ones, because they're the ones that get repeated more often than not. So to the idea that actually, you know, you don't need anything really special, or you know, you don't need the perfect snazzy birth pool, you don't need the perfect lights or the perfect whatever it is that you think you need. Actually, you just need a space, hopefully one that's nice and comfortable and familiar with you, and ideally the right people in the room with you supporting you. So whether that is the whole family, or whether it's actually kind of just you and maybe one other person that you've carefully chosen to be there with you, or you know,
that's
whatever.
How my grandchild was born 3 weeks ago. My second grandchild was born with just my son present.
Oh, congratulations.
My daughter-in-law gave birth. So they were just in their bedroom, popped the baby out in a couple of hours. Whilst I had their eldest, their first child, I took him out, brought him brunch.
Oh, lovely. Congratulations.
Did she catch her own baby then? Or,
she did, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, she did.
Fabulous.
That's incredible.
I know. Isn't it fabulous?
We definitely love it. Yeah, it is. And I love that on your Instagram account and on some of the ones that we both follow, where there's just so much visibility now on physiological, empowering, beautiful vaginal births.
Yes.
I think it's helping create new imprints for people.
Thank you for saying that. It is creating the new imprints for people, because, you know, we're all educators. And we could talk to everybody in the face. It's actually what is happening to the mindscape of the woman who's watching those images, who's watching those videos.
Yeah.
It, you know, so I know sometimes people say social media, you know, they've got their negative things to say about it. But one of the positives, one of the things I love is how it's exposing alternative views of birth to what TV used to. The television, you'd never catch that. You'd only ever catch the medicalized, you know, Rachel on Friends
saving
type
the day
stuff.
Bit.
Yeah, and yeah, and then, you know, the God complex being massaged by them riding in a white coat and scrubs and treating you like you're nuclear waste again. It's like I was watching a clip the other day on, and I think I shared it on Instagram, and I saw this beautiful, I know her, Marin Green, of Indie Birth. She doesn't wear gloves, neither do I. And to just see her bare hands, you know, she tries not to touch the children, so do I, but I think she had to touch the baby briefly at one point. You saw her hands, no gloves. Like, this is, which is, this is, it's a
it's
sacred,
humane, isn't
that's
it?
Right, it's a sacred, beautiful thing. And I just, you know, I just feel that when women see you come to them in ordinary clothes, not a uniform, and you're coming in just clothes and bare hands and smiles, and to see tears on my face, all of that, I'm feeling welling up now, because I do get emotional. I do get emotional when I watch a woman just burst into her power or discover herself. I know we've got to end, but I just want to say the last birth I attended in the UK, which is a couple of months ago, she'd been severely traumatised by her first birth. Not intentionally, I would admit. She had her own midwife, but the way the birth went, then she had to transfer to the hospital, and then she was mistreated a bit at the hospital. So she really didn't want to go back there. And during her birthing process, she'd done so much work during her pregnancy, but during, you get confronted during birth, it squeezes it out of you. So with the best will, and she had fears about a repeat of her first birth. And then we got over that hump, and it was psychological. It was her looking into my eyes. It's me touching her body. It was me crying with her. That's what enabled her to get to the next stage. It wasn't how many times I could listen to the baby, because I didn't. it wasn't like, you know, whether I could get out something medical. It wasn't that. It was just me being there, and she had a friend there, and we held her as she cried and she worried and she thought she couldn't do it. And that was an hour before she held her daughter. She brought her daughter up in the pool. She brought her daughter up, and she put her daughter in her hands like that, looking at her, and she said, "I'm not broken. I'm not broken." That's the first two things she said to her baby. Of course, who can stay, who cannot cry witnessing that? And yet, you know, I remember from when I was in the system, they kept trying to dehumanize us. Like, don't show emotion, it's unprofessional. Don't knit with them, it's unprofessional. Don't eat or drink in front of them, it's unprofessional. Like, trying to make us into robots. But yeah, bringing your whole humanity. So I just say, anyone who's going to support somebody, or, you know, that sixth thing I was going to say, probably in the cat and what's only five, is that please only give birth to people you know respect and trust you. If they don't respect and trust you, you're almost safer giving birth on your own. I'm being serious.
Yeah. And it's that lovely sacred rite of passage, not a medicalized event. Yeah. Kemi, you've been wonderful. We could talk to you for hours. We really hope we'll have you back again. And we can have more incredible geek out chats.
Oh, my word. Really, it's my awesome. Favourite thing. My favourite thing. Get a Prosecco out and geek out for hours.
So have you got something that, you know, as a birth keeper, as a former midwife, is there something that people might not expect about you that's true?
It depends. I hope you like this one. I hope it resonates. Well, it won't resonate, but I'm a birth keeper, but I love an early night, and if given the opportunity, would only attend birth during the hours of 10 a.m. and 6 p.m.
Love it. Sleep is precious.
It's become a bit too precious to me, honestly. I would literally say, look, why don't you just talk amongst yourselves? I'll be back in at 10. You'll see me at 10 tomorrow morning.
Love that.
That's brilliant.
The other question we like to ask is, what are you grateful for in your life right now?
Grandchild cuddles. Little pudgy arms around the neck. Yeah, that's it.
Adorable.
Totally filling my heart hearing about that. And the other thing, we believe that each child brings a gift. Do you agree? And what do you feel your children have brought you?
Oh, God, you're going to set me off again. Yeah. My children saved my life. I was, I would have been a mess without them. They taught me how to laugh, big belly laughs, and taught me how to wait, taught me how to listen. Yeah, they literally saved my life. Oh, and taught me how to be direct, like, really brutally direct, and it saved me a lot of time and trouble just telling it as it is. So yeah they saved my life.
Oh, what fabulous gifts. And that's really special. Thank you so much, Kemi, for sharing that with us.
Amazing questions. Thank you. Amazing questions. An amazing session. And I'd come back in a heartbeat.
Really. Oh, thank you. Please, we'd love to have you. And yes, we'll definitely geek out some more. Thanks so much, Kemi.
Thank you.
Loads and loads of love, Kemi. Have a fabulous rest of your time on your travels.
Thank you, I will.
Look forward to seeing your next wonderful posts on Instagram. If people aren't already following you, we'll put all your links in the show
notes. Thank you so much. Bye for now. Look after yourselves.